Some doors are best left closed. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original Iggy and the Drones podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided it was time to rebrand and relaunch just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. Be sure to check www.whitebookpodcast.com for more content, generally in written form. Huge thanks go out to George R.R. Martin for creating this world, FFG for a great game, all of our contributors, and you, the listeners. Contact us on this site, facebook.com, as well as Twitter, or email contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This Creative Commons music is Townfish by Spinners.
Welcome. Like the one between England and America?
That's a short quote.
Yeah, you really don't want to let that happen.
Worrisome.
Man, I expected a little bit more of a giggle and kind of some friendly rivalry back and forth. Now I just sound like an ass.
Well, we've slammed that door closed twice. We're not really worried about them.
The last time was in 1812. It's been a while.
We didn't slam the door in 1812. Let's be honest about history here.
Well, with help we did. And if you're saying that it's been that long and now maybe it's open again, I say just bring it.
Tommy, waging a one-man war against...
I think we're kind of past our point of trying to keep an empire together. I think we're willing to take the licks now.
Who are you? Why did we let a British person on?
I've heard someone say on Facebook group that they like hearing British accents on podcasts, so I thought I'd save them from having to listen to Banter Behind the Throne.
God damn it, my wife is posting
That's
again.
Valuable.
Everyone's
well, welcome
better
back
than Tom.
To the White Book. I'm Will. And no one else is on the show, evidently. Everyone clammed up.
Except
okay,
for Tommy,
this is gonna be
Aaron,
a quick
James,
one.
And Greg.
There we go. Wait, who's James?
Hi.
Oh, wait, no. He specifically told me to call him Easy early.
I said that's who I am.
It's an identity issue. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, this is a terrible opening. Let's move on.
It's not been the
really
best.
It really is. Man, the magic just is not there tonight. I apologize to the listeners.
Will, why don't you hurry up and throw out a topic that I can yell at Aaron about? Everyone loves to hear that, so.
Oh, okay. Well, before we get into topics that you can yell at Aaron about, I've actually got a couple bits of newsy announcement-y type things. One being, of course, once again, propping the Discord server. There will be links in the postings, so hop in there. The group continues to grow. It's a good place to chit-chat. But as well, I want to acknowledge that we seem to have not ironed out all of the issues that the site has had lately. I've been hearing some intermittent reports of people having trouble logging in. I seem to have that fixed for some people, but not everyone. So if you're having trouble logging in, it seems to be causing some kind of loop where folks just get sent back to the login page over and over. So if you would... either post on Facebook or shoot us an email, contact@whitebookpodcast.com, and let me know if it's doing that for you and what type of login you're trying that with, be that Facebook, Yahoo, Google, that sort of thing, or the traditional email and password route. And we'll see if we can get that figured out. As well, folks have pointed out that we're having some issues with the RSS feed. So that's something else for me to dig into. Doing a little bit of research on that. Hopefully I will have that ironed out soon.
Hey, we also have some trouble on iTunes, just while we're here.
Well, that I believe is due to the central RSS feed issue.
Absolutely is.
That feed is just submitted to iTunes as well as a couple other sites where folks have reported having some issues. So I apologize if you happen to be a guru with that sort of thing. Feel free to get a hold of. Okay, enough with the newsy type stuff. That kind of. On to topics Greg and Aaron will disagree about.
Woo. Today is Wednesday.
Yeah, it's Wednesday. Hello.
You're not Greg.
I thought it was Friday.
Exactly what I was expecting.
Wait, Friday, I thought it was Thursday for you, James.
Yeah, it's Thursday for me.
Motherfucker.
Man, calling us from the future. Yeah. How crazy is that?
It's great. You can download rice here. It's insane.
And here I was just going to ask if the chapter pack was out yet in the future, but man.
No, I think we're still waiting on Pack 2. No.
Well, in the meantime, you know what we did get related to Pack 3? We got a couple new spoilers, thanks to Team Covenant, threw some out here. So that's pretty exciting. We're not going to inundate you guys with a deep review of those because we're going to be hitting up a review episode before long, hopefully next week if we've got everything available to us. But they threw out Sir Gregor Clegane and a little Night's Watch attachment, the Practice Blade. What do you guys think? Should I read those to the listeners?
Do it.
Seems solid.
All right. Gregor is a 7-cost Lannister unique, only one icon, military, but he has 10 strength and is non-loyal. House Clegane, knight and lord traits, pillage and renown, and then the reaction after Sir Gregor Clegane discards a character using pillage, place that card in its owner's dead pile. Then you may choose and kill a character with printed cost equal to that card's printed cost.
Okay, before we go hog wild... Best Sir Gregor art we've seen so far?
Oh, by far. Yeah.
All right, also, continue.
I hate that card. Know why?
Because you hate variants?
I hate everything named Greg.
Ooh, wow, that is patently offensive.
He's not even defending himself.
My boss at work's named Greg.
Honestly, Aaron, I recommend such opinions. So I think you should convince everyone to have the same thought process as you. Makes my life a lot easier.
All right, keep going.
So. Yeah, Gregor then. Are we talking about him or am I reading the next card? Oh, thought there'd be a little bit of...
Okay, we can discuss
it. Well, you guys told me not to discuss it because you're going to discuss it next week, so I'm biting my tongue.
Well, no, I just meant we weren't going to, like, delve down deep into a, card review analysis, but tentatively speaking, I like him. I'm a little worried about that. Whether that another 7-cost slot fits up there, but I do like more renown. As we've been talking about, renown's more potent.
7-cost non-loyal, possibly fits a different slot.
Yeah.
I very much like him. Now, if you're comparing him to Tywin and saying, am I choosing Gregor or Tywin, you're looking at it all wrong. He's not a replacement for Tywin. In my mind, he's a 7-coster you're playing when you're bannering to Lannister, particularly if you're playing another house where you don't like their 7-coster or he doesn't really fit. And he's going to be a lot better over the next 6 months, a year or two from now when people are playing fewer unique. I think his power level is going to go down and he'll be a card that sits in the binder. But right now, I think he's going to see a lot of play and will be impactful in game.
Mr. Wamsley.
I mean, a lot of what Greg said, I think he's a very cool card. I really like the sort of the random sort of theme for Lannister. And I think if any character was going to sort of have a like incredibly wild effect that misses a lot of the time, but is super impactful when it hits, it makes sense for that to be Gregor. I think that he's a lot scarier, like looking at him now than he will be in games. Simply because he attracts all of the hate that all 7-costers attract. You know, he's useless if you kneel him, if you blank him, if you remove his icon. And Tears. When they're a 7-coster, generally, like, look at, like, say, the Queen of Thorns, who, on the face of it, has a really cool ability where she, you know, can accelerate your economy by, you know, like 6 gold in one trigger. But that's only when you actually get her to work. And in practice, very few people have got her to work successfully, consistently. So I think that Gregor looks a lot better here than he will be in practice for that reason. Like the 7-costers that people play either completely dominate games consistently, like Robert, or they provide you something even when they're not working fully, like Tywin, who even if you kneel him, he's still going to give you the +2 gold.
So much of what you said right there kind of plays exactly into the point that I was going to make, is that is anyone else bothered on the Nedley level that the best fit for this is Martell Banner Lion.
Why is Martell the best fit?
Yeah.
I thought Rose
was. Yeah, I think the best fit surely is Tyrell, because then you can use Baron Maiden Fair to stack your deck.
Yeah, and okay, so that's Rose to stack power on him.
That's super and fun also, and stuff, but the fact that the 7 coster in Martell is not worth playing at all, and the fact that...
I don't think
you, I'm sorry? Are you about to make an argument for the Red Viper?
I don't think he's better than Viper.
Come on,
make it. I don't think he's better than
Viper.
Outside
of your damn mind.
I don't. Like, there, 7 strength
no
for 3 different
world.
Challenges.
No. There's no world where the Red Viper is better than this guy. In versatility, in board impact, none of it. Unless maybe you're talking about melee.
I think Viper has much more versatility. I think 3 icons to 1 is much harder to control.
You're talking about versatility in a single situation. I'm talking about versatility across deck building.
They're just two different. They're two different characters, guys. Gregor is a tempo card. He's a guy that's intended to make sure you win a military challenge, who gives you that option, the easy option of playing put to the sword. And in the case when his ability goes off, which won't be a high percentage, but you're also knocking another character off the board and changing the tempo by moving a character into their dead pile and potentially making several cards useless. The Viper is not a tempo guy. You know, the Viper, you know, is essentially a power grab guy, you know, when used correctly with some, you know, decent strength and versatility in the challenge phase. So they're just two different characters for different purposes.
So you're making my point for me, Greg. Who fills that role that you just explained for Martell right now? Nobody. Nobody makes the auto put to the sword. Nobody owns the military challenge. Even if she steals the military icon from the best person over there, that doesn't even necessarily say, because of Sirio, oh, nobody's going to touch military. But to your point that was made previously, all the hate is going to get poured onto this guy. So that leaves Nymeria clear to do her business, as well as Ariane. And then you're obviously jumping Hound in. All the other shenanigans that you want to be doing are cleaned up because this guy's out there. They have to deal with him.
I disagree so much. Like, if I could choose to kill either the Hound or Nymeria, I'm killing Nymeria 10 times out of 10.
Sure, but what if this guy's out there with Nymeria?
I'm killing Nymeria first, if at all possible.
I think I still lean towards Nymeria. But, I mean, it's kind of a skill tester thing at that point. Does your opponent make the right choice on what to get rid of?
And what is your kill option? What do you have in your hand that's going to kill Nymeria, right? Is it Tears of Bliss where she's going to steal an intrigue icon? Even
is
if you don't have one
every time,
in the event where she's afraid of tears, possible. In the event where
she's afraid of tears,
afraid
then she's
of
never
the
taking
sword,
anything
you're
else.
Not going to win a military challenge by 5 because of this guy. I'm saying that if
you
have
sure
those two guys out there
really?
No. What's your removal strategy?
Like,
what are you going to do?
Aspect with Gregor, one other aspect with Gregor that also hurts his power level, just briefly to say, is the fact that you've got to assume that at those really high impact cost slots, the sort of characters you're actually scared of losing, you know, your 5, 6, 7 costers, you're not going to have that many of them. So the odds of Gregor actually doing some serious damage are actually quite small. His main boost is just being that 10 strength military beat stick, and maybe occasionally, you know, you'll clip off a reducer and take out a second one or whatever, or, you know, you're busted in hiding, will let you kill Shireen or something.
I look at that reaction as situational as Heads on Spikes. It's the same type
of thing.
Yeah,
those are not great cards. Like, they're good, but they're not great. They're not for every deck. They're not that balanced. They're very balanced.
This reaction is a rider, though. It's not making it a great card because it has that reaction. The fact that it's the reaction tacked onto the best body in the entire game. Like,
isn't that the best body?
I don't understand.
It's high strength. That doesn't make him the best body. Like, he's got one icon.
Okay. I understand your point. Yes. When
like
I said
Sirio,
best body,
I'd rather have
I meant
Sirio.
Legitimately strength.
Fine. I'd rather have Sirio almost every time.
I do want to make this note that through the history of the game, both in LCG and CCG, many of the Gregors had either no attachments or no attachments except weapon, and he does not have that keyword. So the idea of putting, obviously, Little Bird or...
Noble,
you know, one or the other, or the other thought of putting a seal of the hand on him to where he can trigger on defense and offense. You know, I think that there's going to be some more utility out of him, but he's not going to be an auto include. I really do believe that he is intentionally going to go in tempo based aggro decks. You know, you guys were arguing over which house. You know, I actually think Targ main house with you know, Banner to Lion is going to make a great case for him, just because he fits in a way that allows Targ to deal tempo damage either through Dracarys or power challenge with Plaza or military challenge with him. You know, they have different options and they leave the opponent guessing as to what those options are going to be.
I just said, should we spend 10 minutes on Practice Blade now?
Yeah, let's move on. We'll argue.
I think that sounds like a wonderful idea. Okay, so Practice Blade then. That is going to be a Night's Watch attachment, of course, non-unique and non-loyal. It's one cost, it's a weapon. Night's Watch character only, ambush 2, and the attached character gains +1 strength and a military icon.
My first thought is that I'm sad that it's Night's Watch character and Lisa Gregor can't hold it and get even stronger.
Which is just what we would need.
Yeah, but if it wasn't that, imagine that on Randall.
There you go.
Yeah, you can't take Widow's Will or anything like that.
No, read what it does.
+1 strength.
Does anyone else find it interesting that the ambush cost really is higher than the printed gold cost?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's not the first card we've seen that way.
Others all had a special effect for being ambushed in.
Right.
I think it makes an interesting choice of, do you want to benefit economically or from the surprise factor? Like, if you've got the spare gold, then perhaps you gain more from getting the effect unexpectedly than you do from having that gold for dominance or whatever.
Right. Or maybe that's the strength you need to win the challenge, or
to not lose by 5 and let them undercommit a little bit, or count your strength with what's his name, Balon.
I think the problem it's got at the moment is the number of Night's Watch characters that you want to actually put it on. Like, there are a couple of good targets, but there really aren't that many.
I mean, that's the problem with Night's Watch at this point, no?
I think the card shines when Castle Black is out, with the notion that you are, you know, you're turning one of your weaker characters, maybe a Samwell Tarly, into a 2-strength character with a military icon, kneel to defend a military challenge, give him another +2 with Castle Black, stand him, draw a card. So, you know, for me, that's where I'm looking at, is I'm turning one of these small utility Night's Watch characters into a character that can actually defend and win when Castle Black is out, and then continue to stand and attack back.
Yeah, I think that's all fair.
Yeah, I think it's a very good card. I think I'd run in Night's Watch.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
I actually like it better than Gregor.
But I think it's a more efficient card than Gregor, for sure. It's less situational.
Mm-hmm. It just fits more. All right.
I'm meh on it. I just don't really care. Detachments still don't sizzle for me.
Ooh, we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it, but not phenomenal. But I think that probably covers the main bullets on this particular card. So I say let's keep the episode rolling here, guys, because we've got another new card, I'm going to put here in quotes, that we wanted to hit on, because it has caused quite a community uproar, shall we say, at the moment. And that is the existence, or soon-ish to be existence, of the plot Valor Morghulis. Now, for listeners that may not have caught it, go listen to the latest episode of
Beyond the Wall.
Beyond the Wall. Sorry, I wanted to say Beyond the White Book for a minute there.
You should watch that,
hearing
too.
You talk about that. Yeah, Beyond the Wall, who has a phenomenal interview with Nate French, talking about his 10th anniversary with FFG, which I really dig. And he mentions in that interview that that Valor is, just like he said when the game relaunch was first announced, is coming. And that's, I want to stress, at the moment, all we know. But it has caused quite a community outcry at the moment, so we wanted to touch on that. I'm kind of curious what my co-hosts think on that front.
Screw outcry. It should be a round of applause.
Well, it's a mix, I suppose. What's a good word that doesn't necessarily mean it's all negative? There's some on the positive and the negative side.
Discourse?
Well, yeah, but I'm thinking louder and more forceful.
Heated discourse?
That might work.
Fighting.
Might
work.
Well, let me...
sometimes it's nearly gotten.
Let me share some quick history for our listeners that may not know. Valor has been an iconic card in the game almost through its entire history. It was not released in the very first base set during the CCG era, but it was released in the very first expansion to the base set, the one that introduced Greyjoy into the game. And then the following year, when the second base set was released, Ice and Fire, Valor was also printed in there. So it's one of the first and maybe only non-economy card that actually was printed in multiple sets within an era. And when I say that, I mean like within the CCG era or within the LCG era, so on and so forth. And it did rotate out after 3 years when they had, you know, rotation, and it did not come back, but people still knew very much what Valor did. When the LCG launched, Valor was in the core set. And so for the entirety of the LCG era, since there was no rotation, Valor was, you know, not just iconic, but a prevalent plot to how the game ran. It was probably a year or two ago, Will, you even wrote an article. I think it was on Card Game DB. I'm not sure, but, you know, basically, you know, about the presence of Valor and how it's necessary to the game and so on and so forth. So when Nate says Valor's coming back, or, you know, both before the podcast and then confirmed within the podcast, it should be noted that 13 years of the game existing and this card existing, it number one gets a first name basis. Even though there was another card that's existed called Valor Doharis, you know, there is no confusion. When people say Valor, they know what you're talking about. Second, because of its place in the metagame, I would argue, and I might argue incorrectly, but I would argue that when Nate says it's coming back, there's not a lot of room for ambiguity on what he means. Now, we may not know exact stats. We don't know exact stats. Well, not if, but when. And the premise is that it's going to kill all characters.
Well, we assume it.
Well, that's why I gave this whole 10-minute interlude to that, is basically that I think that is not just a reasonable assumption. I think it's almost a concrete assumption.
I mean, historically, that's been the case, but with the wide rebalancing of the game scheme, you know, would you say the flavor of Valor is still there if it came out and killed all characters of strength 5 or lower, or any number of other variables?
It says it right there in the name. All men must die.
Okay, so what if it came out and said, kill all Lord characters? Choose all non-lady characters. Kill those characters. You know? I don't know. There's just such a wide range of stuff, or other balancing factors, or just depressing factors. You know,
so, like, if it said, kill all characters cannot be saved. That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. Or it could be like the replacement plot we had, Winter Has Come, during that period of the CCG where Greg mentioned we didn't have Valor, where you were locked into a chain of traded plots, and it was cannot be saved, but also could only be played after you already had two of those traded plots in your used pile. So turn 3 at the earliest.
The problem with that, though, is that do you want to make a chain of plots ubiquitous, or do you want to make a single card ubiquitous? Because I think Greg was a little bit wrong when he said that Valor was prevalent. It was literally ubiquitous. When you played in competitive tournaments at the Worlds or Gen Con level, it was maybe one out of the field that wasn't playing Valor.
And if Valor's 2004, I don't know if I'm playing it all the time.
Well, you're crazy.
Well, or even, like, there's a ton of other stuff. Like, if it said, when revealed, kill all characters, then discard your hand.
Yeah.
You know, like, does everybody play that? Like,
no,
then now you have no ability to bank anything. Yeah, and here's my issue with the discussion is it could say that. We have no idea. And it makes it really hard to judge the impact without knowing.
Well, but to Greg's point, it was the same in the CCG as it was in the LCG. Why would we believe that they would radically change it?
Can you point out any other cards in second edition that are printed exactly the same as they were in first?
Yeah, sure. Knight of the Tumblestone.
No, It's not exactly.
He doesn't have a fucking war crest, okay? That doesn't exist.
Not the war crest. They also changed his name, but
what about like Milk of the Poppy?
There you go. That's closer.
They added the word terminal stuff. In adding the word terminal, that just means
it makes it even closer. Yeah.
Right. So, but here's the thing, though. In the scheme of things, you picked one card that it was in first edition and so far has panned out in second edition to be a very, very minor, some might sometimes argue, ineffectual component of the broader metagame and the mechanical integrity of gameplay as a whole. The other is one that we've seen very fairly wildly in usefulness, but was a member of a card subtype, attachments, that was specifically being pushed and having their mechanics altered for second edition versus Valor.
If you work your way into the plots, I mean, your argument kind of fizzles because there are so many plots where the text is virtually identical. And the only thing that's different is a point here, a point there on a different item of the stat line. Like your Wild Wildfires, your March to the Wall.
So then let's say, so what stat line wouldn't we all play Valor at? Assuming Valor maintained, when revealed, kill all characters in play.
That's a good question.
What stat line, one by one, wouldn't you play Valor at? I will not play, or I will very rarely at the very least play Valor at 2-0-0.
I can't yell at Aaron. I agree with him. If it's 2-0-0-4, I likely am not playing it very often. Either.
I think it loses you the game when you use it.
I think it's tough. There are now two stats on that matter to me. Initiative and claim, those can be zero. My initiative could be -3. I don't care.
If the claim was higher than zero, I think it would see play even if it had low gold.
Yeah,
very
agreed.
Very possibly. Though I find it, knowing or assuming that the effect is the same when revealed, kill all characters, no other effect.
You're assuming zero.
I assume there's not going to be any claim tagged along with that because that would be very bizarre from a balance perspective. So then you start looking at the common uses of Valor and kind of, you know, banking stuff in your hand and trying to come back onto the board and such. So that makes me worry about the reserve. At 4 reserve, I'm less likely to play it. But the way the economy is in second edition, I feel like I've got to consider that too. At 2 gold, I might. At 2 and 4, probably not. But if it was 2 and 6, maybe. On the other hand, if it was 6 reserve and 0 gold, I'm back to being maybe not.
So, but Will, you know that you have it in your plot deck, right? And even though you only have 2 gold, and even though you're only going to have 4 cards, you can choose to play it such that you're going to eliminate characters that were so much more gold to put out there and gain you such an economy and card advantage versus your opponent, and it's going to make the entry challenge matter so much more than it does right now. I mean, Aaron, you talk all the time about how much you like using Varus for that very purpose. You pretty much are going to be able to do that on command, and guarantee if you want to build your deck to clean out your opponent's hand and then play Valor, you have 4 cards, they have 0, and you've killed everything on the board. It doesn't matter that you have the one turn with 2 gold.
It does matter that you have the one turn with 2 gold, because as we've seen in first edition forever, when Valor is going to be played tends to be fairly predictable. Fair?
Not if you're doing it on an offense.
If you're choosing to Valor, it's still fairly predictable when you're going to Valor. You've played enough first edition to know better than that. Like, sometimes you don't Valor just because you think it's so goddamn predictable, but when your opponent's going to Valor, you either play something like Summons to get another key character, or you play something with 2 claim, and you say, now you don't get to play any cards. Because your no claim versus my now 2 claim means that with 2 gold, especially given second edition gold curves, you're not going to have a goddamn thing out. Now I've got the next turn. Like, by the time you have claim again, I've already re-upped myself on the board to you. And you didn't have any claim to get rid of whatever intrigue for that turn, so now we're almost even in hand, and I'm ahead in board. So what have you actually accomplished at that point? You've killed some stuff, yes, but you've put yourself in a really bad position if the stats are low enough. In first edition, when you had streets and everything else and cards cost generally less, it was not the same thing as when your average cost of a character is probably something like 3 or 4.
I, in theory, agree with you, but I think that the framing of the plot is going to change from a potentially rallying plot, a potential catch-up plot, to one that in the hands of a skilled player will be used offensively to ensure victory.
One thing I'll say is that one of the few complaints I hear about 2.0 is that it has a more of a snowball effect than the game has had in a long time. Basically being if one person gets a huge jump on the other one, like a 6-to-1 character advantage, that it's much harder to come back from that for the average player. So I think what's going to happen is even for those people that don't like Valor, assuming, again, it says the kill all characters when revealed, people are going to start playing it anyways just for the idea that I'm playing this as an anti-snowball plot. If the game is already getting away from me that I'm seeing I'm going to lose, this is my one chance to get back in.
James?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot with what Greg said, but I mean, I'm probably a bad person to ask as far as what stats would make me not play it, because I didn't enjoy playing Valor in first edition. The most successful I've ever been at a tournament was when I didn't have Valor in my plot deck. It's just an effect, like Aaron was saying, I find it such a predictable effect in practice that a good opponent can generally play around it. And it's a card that gets worse the higher up in a field you are. That said, I think almost regardless of what the stats are, it will be very powerful for Martell decks. They've got the long plan. They've got In Doran's Name or whatever it's called, which is going to be like those surprise burst economy cards are going to be vital even when Valor comes out. They've got Bastard Daughter that lets them shred the opponent's hand on their own Valor. There's a lot of good stuff there. Equally, Greyjoy, they've got Risen from the Sea. They've got Iron Mines. I think those two factions will be able to leverage Valor very well. I think what you won't see so much is rush decks playing Valor, whereas typically in first edition, a rush deck would run Valor because it was a case of, oh, if I'm behind, I'll probably need it. If I'm ahead, then it doesn't matter because I'm going to win before I have to Valor myself anyway. I think those types of decks just won't be able to Valor because the tempo loss will be too high.
For me, the biggest concern with Valor is that I do feel like the game right now in second edition has landed on a nice balance between low-cost characters and high-cost characters. What I mean by that is, even though there's some decks that don't run 7-cost characters and maybe only run, you know, 1 6-cost character, the majority of them still do. And my concern is even if the plot is bad, its presence in the environment is going to cause people to move away from playing many of these 7-cost characters, particularly in triplicate in their deck, for fear of just someone hitting their Valor and cutting the very fabric of the deck apart by removing the 7-cost character, you know, with little to no effort. And that's my fear. I hope it's unfounded, but I like the fact right now that characters have a little bit more staying power on the board. Yes, you can still, you know, knock off a big character with a Tears or put to the sword or ice or something like that, but it takes a little work. You know, it's not easy. You have to take some effort and planning and strategy to pull it off, you know, but with Valor, it's flip a plot and they're all dead. And so that's what concerns me a little bit, is just how it's going to affect the cost curve, and is it going to drive it down in such a way that these 7 and 6-cost characters aren't making it out of our collection boxes or card sleeves?
That's a legitimate comment of concern, but let's look at it in context of things that we know that are happening for sure, like the fact that we know that First Snow of Winter is coming, right? So as soon as that plots in the meta, what becomes the best slot in terms of cost? You know, four. Right? So if you then go and build a deck full of efficient 4 and 5-cost cards, you're inherently going to say, oh, 7-costers, fuck you, because you can't keep up. I'm just going to flood the board with my awesome 4 and 5s between my 2 banner houses, and you can't keep up. Or if you're playing your low-cost guys, I'm just going to bounce them back to your hand, and you're going to be screwed. So by having Valor in the environment, you're able to say, well, I have an answer to your 4 and 5-cost guys, because you can go wide with them, but I can have my duplicated or triplicated 7-cost guy survive Valor, and your 4 and 5-cost guys are dead, and I keep my renown on my important guy. I think that there's a good balancing act happening between those two plots being in the environment.
I think also with Valor, it's a case of it's only one card, and it's a very, very powerful effect, obviously. But the card pool can have effects that balance it out. Like, for example, one of the foreign cards that was spoiled a few months ago was for a plot that moves a character from your dead pile to your discard pile, assuming if we can trust the translation. And I think cards like that mean that you can still run your big guy in triplicate, and if they kill your big guy, then you can just move them out of your dead pile and play another copy. And with like Bodyguard, quite a lot of the big characters are lords or ladies, and attachments don't suck for the most part in second edition. And so you can run cards like Bodyguard to protect them. I think it's a case of you definitely can still, or I say definitely can, I'm guessing you will still be able to run those big characters. You've just got to, you can't throw them in. You've got to actually sort of build to actually try to protect them.
Yeah, I'm going to assume Nate knows what he's doing as far as that goes. He doesn't always, obviously. No one ever always does. But, like, you don't release, you don't build an entire game around this high cost curve and then release a, one card that's like, and never mind, everything you just learned, it's not existence anymore. Like, there has to be a balancing factor there. So I'm going to assume that that exists and that there will be a way to play around it and work around it.
Just in the idea phase, he obviously had that in mind because he was willing to announce nothing except for that in his initial statement. So, like Aaron said, I'm confident entirely that he's going to apply it in a way that makes sense and is good for the game.
Yeah, Nate's never going to do anything that's intentionally bad for the game. Can you hear me? I keep getting interrupted.
I can hear you.
No, good.
Will?
Yep. I was just being silent, so I did not talk over anyone.
Okay. Sorry, I'm making sure that you're getting clear. Sorry. Yeah,
okay, so go ahead. I'm going to go ahead and finish my thought then. Obviously, Nate would never intentionally do something that's bad for the game, but playtesting is a finite process. And once cards get introduced to the public, that finite process from playtesting gets expounded significantly. It's not infinite, but it essentially, you know, the cards that can only get playtested a certain amount over a certain month period now, you know, are getting playtested, you know, at a much exponentially increased rate. So it's not a matter of trusting Nate or not, because inherently we do, because he's designing this game that we love. It's really just looking at it and saying, you know, what are the true implications? James mentioned just a little while ago about Greyjoy. I think Greyjoy will get a significant jump when this plot comes out, because they are the only house, you know, other than Maester Aemon, that has in-house saves. And between Three Iron Mines that's coming out later, which has been spoiled, and, you know, three of the, you know, event saves, that's pretty significant of the possibility of playing a Valor and being left with three characters on the board and your opponent having none. I don't even care what my gold or my claim or reserve is at that point in time. If I have three significant characters to my opponent's none after a Valor, that's a huge swing.
Mm-hmm. So this conversation, I didn't think this before the conversation, but I am coming out of this almost certain that Valor is going to be in a chapter pack, not a deluxe box.
This was my question I was going to ask, is do you think it should be evergreen, or do you think it should cycle out?
I think all of this conversation about how, like, what if they kind of, I don't want to say screwed up, like, but don't, it doesn't have the exactly the anticipated impact. I think sticking in the chapter pack is a really good idea.
Mm. I think it also depends when
it can always reprint it.
Exactly. You can make sure if the format is takes it okay, that it stays effectively evergreen without leaving yourself the possibility of being stuck if it's in a chat, or sorry, in a deluxe.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and I'll say that I thought multiple occasions in 1.0 that there was room for different resets to come in. Like, I would have really loved to have seen Winterstorm get reprinted in the LCG from the CCG. Like, I didn't play in the CCG, but just knowing what that card was and how it worked, I thought that that would have been a phenomenal effect. And if they want to rotate out Valor and give us Winterstorm, awesome.
What's Winterstorm?
It's Aftermath. Did get it reprinted, essentially.
It's different. It had one less initiative, but otherwise.
Yeah, it's pretty much
the same.
Wasn't
it choose two characters?
No, it was
no,
three.
It was three.
Instead of three?
It was three. Yeah.
No, as Will said, there was very little difference in the cards.
Okay, so I think we've beaten that into the ground.
I would definitely say that we have.
One last thing I wanted to say about it very briefly is on Facebook, there was a bit of a dispute where I felt that players who are new to second edition felt that first edition players weren't taking their worries about the card seriously, sort of having a very dismissive, oh, it was fine in first edition, I'm sure it will be fine in second edition attitude. And I want to just sort of say that I think people are trying to evaluate the card on its merits in second edition. But at the same time, there is, as Greg mentioned, 13 years of history of this card existing. And yes, being a very important definitive card, but also being fine and the game not falling apart. And I've seen people sort of saying things like, if you win with Valor, that's not a real win. And it's like, it's a real card. You know, it's just part of the game. It's not, you know, it's a powerful effect, but it's not some other being. It's just a card in the game that you have to learn to play with, play against, play around.
Yeah, isn't it really awkward when people agree on the show?
No, it's
that
not.
Is not what I hired you for. You guys are not getting a paycheck this week.
Actually, Tommy did yell at Aaron earlier, so I guess he filled up the yelling quota.
Okay. Whew. As long as somebody did, then I guess
we'll find more. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay, well,
now we'll find more. Find now.
let's kick things over to what was originally going to be the main topic of the podcast, but considering as how we're nearly an hour in, who knows? It may be a smaller segment than I had expected.
Will said talk fast.
To be fair, half of that hour was just us sort of starting to talk and then realizing someone else was talking and interrupting and apologizing and saying, go on. And it was all very British. It made me feel very at home.
Conversational pump fakes.
Glad we could help. Well then, tell you what, James, since you're the special guest here that brought a topic to the table, why don't you kind of let us know what you were thinking for this one?
Okay. So basically the idea was to look at sort of the spine of a typical deck, like what cards are sort of auto includes for the different types of decks. How does that change compared to the core set environment now that we've got a couple of packs out? Specifically, how is the income base settling down? How many characters should you be running? What sort of gold curves? And how, like, what sort of ratio do you have of the attachments, events, locations? Just, you know, if you saw a deck, what would your immediate thoughts be? Like, oh, you've put in 40 characters, that's a lot, or should 40 be the norm? You know, sort of establishing that kind of thing.
So in the 222 episode, like, that sort of kicked off our, like, major 2.0 coverage, we sort of identified three deck types. One was, like, all the expensive characters times three, and I feel like that's kind of entirely gone away, except for that one Alex Frog deck. Like, no one really plays that way. And the other two have really come to the fore. The mini curve, although first edition curve sounds way cooler, so that is playing really well and winning more and more tournaments, it seems. And then a deck that runs like 36 characters, like 5 or 6 events, and like 5 or 6 attachments, 10 events, 11 locations, seems to be semi-normal.
I don't feel like it's changed much, just on a generic level. When I hear people say, you know, oh, this deck that I've been playing, I've only adjusted by 5 or 6 cards since the last two chapter packs that come out, that seems like a very normal adjustment to me. The core set, I believe, had like either 18 or 19 cards per faction, and each of the two chapter packs has come out with 2, grand total of 2 new cards per faction each, so each faction has gotten 4 more cards. So, you know, I think understanding that not all 4 of those are going to be just immediately playable in every deck, you know, and you're playing a deck that's either 1 faction fealty or no agenda or 2 factions, you know, the added number of cards to the card pool is approximately 20% per faction. So I don't think we've had enough cards added to see a specific change outside of metagame shifts.
I think metagame shifts are probably the most potent area of that, and also obviously the neutrals, because there's been quite a few tasty neutrals so far.
I mean, right. One major
even
thing.
Just,
go ahead, Will.
I was just going to say, even out of the existing ones, I think that the distribution of what people have been choosing has shifted some. I mean, of course, some of the kind of key income cards in the neutral front are still seeing play, but we've seen definitely the usage of, say, Milk of the Poppy fall off by the wayside and Varus go up. Sure, there's some balancing back and forth, but I think the overall more people have traded what they're doing with that than they were, you know, when the game first launched.
One way of illustrating that, I think, which is what I was going to say before, so thanks for leading in perfectly well. Combo of Westeros has become a very, very popular opener, where it was occasionally seen at the start, and Sneak Attack was at the start, like, a very common opener, where you would see it all the time. And now Sneak is an actively bad opener that you almost never see.
And it's interesting with Calm, because even we were fairly down on Calm when the game started out, but I've found myself coming around on it.
And Calm really is mostly because of the presence of naval superiority. Basically, I'm playing a safe 5 gold opener that I know I don't have to worry about losing my gold, and then I get the chance of choosing, you know, a cushion challenge type that I'm not going to have to worry about claim most likely. So,
see, I think I use it more as a variance mitigator. Like, if I have a poor setup, and given the extent of the gold curve's differences, I think bad setups are more likely, even in decks that do set up well. I use it because sometimes you do set up those, like, 3 cards, and a highly aggressive start from your opponent will screw you, and you can just open Calm and sort of, like, use it to slow down your opponent's pace and give yourself the chance to, like, stabilize.
Would you still regularly do that if it was 3 gold, though?
No, but I don't play 3 gold plots almost ever. Like, it has to have enough gold to open with, but given that, like, there's many plots that have 5 gold, I think the reason I run that is because it gives me a chance to come back.
The effect, absolutely. I think it's a perfect storm for an opening plot.
Yeah, I think it's not just one thing. It's the fact that it is safe against naval superiority. It's excellent against aggro decks that are trying to open with 2 claim, or even I've seen some aggro decks trying to open with a Storm of Swords if they get a good setup, and Calm over Westeros just makes them absolutely cry. The fact that it's got good gold, so it lets you increase your board presence reliably because it dodges naval superiority, and it stops the opponent from being able to push too hard on aggro immediately. It's sort of
Your great fringe benefit is that you, on initiative, will still beat anybody that decides that they want to play their noble cause and dump a bunch of shit out there.
Yeah.
You know, and even aside from it being an opener, you mentioning these aggro decks there reminds me, you know, if I feel pretty confident my opponent's not going naval superiority and I can open noble cause or what have you, I found Calm is proving to be a really solid clincher in the, like, to stop a late game push by keeping, you know, power challenges off my back.
There was one play night here in Southwest Missouri where I showed up with kind of an income denial deck. It was Greyjoy Lannister with Brothel Madam and Treacheries to try and deal with King's Roads and the Shipwrights, the Lordsport Shipwright, and of course naval superiority. And I just decided, let's have some fun. I'm just going to start opening games with that plot. Literally before the night was over, people were changing. Will, you remember doing this, right? You knew what I mean. Yeah, you played against the deck, and you're like, I know he's going to open with Naval, so I'm going to play Calm. Like, our meta was shifting within its own play night because of, you know, the tendency I was showing of just opening it. And I was kind of doing that as a test. I wanted to get an idea of how it felt to open, you know, and hit and open and miss and see, you know, how the deck performed differently. But I just found that to be a interesting phenomenon of how Calm was very quickly starting to become, no, open with Calm, save your noble for later. So
another plot.
Do you guys feel like, go ahead, Aaron.
No, please, Tommy.
I was going to say, do you guys feel like you tend to use naval superiority as more of a combo plot than you did early in the game?
I think it's for Varus decks mostly.
What, Varus and then naval?
Yeah, Varus naval. And, yeah, more or less. Especially if you're Night's Watch and you can use Yoren for a 2-card swing.
For all those people that are Night's Watch.
Yeah.
Joey from Cincinnati will love that comment.
Fair. I mean, I'm thinking mostly of Jeremy and Dan, but yeah. Like, Struhel does that to me all the time. And then he always managed to take someone I have my other copy of in the hand. And I'm like, well, that's great. The one card I could afford this turn. You have. I mean, it's also a bit of luck, but yes.
So back to spines. Spines of decks, right? Isn't that what we're talking about?
Spines. Yeah, I've got another one. For the first, like, month and a half of the game, Calling the Banners wasn't seeing an awful lot of play. And Alex Hines actually, like, took one of my decks and was like, well, if we're going to try and use Varus to beat Braithin when Braithin was everywhere, Calling the Banners is absolutely perfect for that. And he started running Calling in that, and, like, it spread like wildfire. No pun intended. What really wasn't on purpose, I didn't realize it until after. But, and then Calling just sort of never left flat decks. It's in an awful lot of decks right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think people sort of got used to, perhaps, like, the people who were loudly stating opinions, the likes of us, at the start of the core set, were sort of still in a first edition mindset and thinking, oh, you don't normally have that many characters on the table, so it's typically going to be, what, like, 5 gold? Why wouldn't you just run Noble Cause? But because of the lack of a hard reset, obviously there's Varus, there's Wildfire, there's sort of semi-resets, but because of the lack of a hard reset, quite often boards will get big. The main way you remove the characters that you care about is target removal rather than by military attrition. So most decks just sort of slowly accrue these 1 and 2 cost weenies that you don't really care about. And as a result, Calling becomes very powerful. It can easily get you 4, 5, 6 gold only a couple of turns into the game.
Does that take a hit once First Snow enters the meta?
Possibly.
That's going to shift some things.
I think First Snow means a lot smaller board states. And I think that's going to be very interesting. Because First Snow tends to get played earlier than Wildfire would, or Wildfire is a late game play, usually. I think First Snow is a very early game play, like Plot 2, Plot 3. And that's going to change an awful lot about how we have to look at decks.
I mean, I can see First Snow being Plot 1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Caring about, you know, variance mitigation. You know, that's what it's in there for. Your opponent gets this great flop with a bunch of small characters, you know, and you're looking at a mediocre flop. You know, First Snow is your variance mitigation for that opening turn.
So, I think March is the best plot in the game right now. Thoughts?
I think that as a Varus player, you're definitely going to be saying that.
I don't play Varus as much anymore.
I find that quite often, if I'm not playing Varus, then March just sits in my plot deck, unless the opponent has a bad mulligan and has to leave one character on the table. Most of the time, if I'm marching, it's just going to take out, you know, one of the 1 cost reducers or one of the 2 cost bicons. It's not going to take out anything significant. And yes, it's got good numbers, so I might still play it just because I want to be able to win initiative. But the effect isn't that great unless you can actually clear the board and just use it to, you know, clean up the duplicates I've been finding.
It's really good with Wildfire, too.
I disagree with James. It's in probably every one of my decks. We mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not a Varus player. I mean, he's in a couple of my decks, but a lower percentage, while March is in almost every single one.
Interesting.
Well, my thought is kind of the opposite of you. I'm not playing it when they have their 1 cost guys on the board. I'm playing it when those guys have already left the board due to claim or other forms of attrition. I'm playing it so that I can, you know, maintain a particular tempo in the game and allow myself to knock off the big character after I've done the work during the challenge phase of getting rid of all the small ones.
That's exactly why I love it, Greg, and I play it for the same reasons.
Yeah, it just makes a really good way to seal that deal, so to speak. Kind of going back to what we were talking about with the reset or capability of people to kind of claw back into games, they're probably banking on keeping their powers character to the last to try to find a way to claw back in. And if you've gotten them down that far, March usually seals that deal.
Well, so I also say that when you're playing against a quintessential Varus player and they think that they're going to make their aggressive Varus play, wipe your board and save their Tywin or their Randall Tarly or whoever, and you're going to have no one and they're going to run to victory and then you flip your March. Like, that's super rewarding.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think it's necessary to also keep people honest on the opening turn. Now, sometimes it's not about honesty. We've all had the hands we don't like. We mulligan. We draw back into our refill hand. And it's like you have a King's Road and then just several copies of 5 and 6 cost characters. And you're just like, crap, I can only play one. That's all I get to do. What an awful start. But then there are people that, you know, maybe aren't thinking about that. And I did mention this is one of the rules in my Dobbler Talk video of rules of setup, which is you just don't set up one big character unless
you absolutely have to, but there's going to be times people look at their opening hand and see, wow, I can put out a Balin and get a seal and a bodyguard on him and have a Rose Road, and this is a solid setup. I've got my big guy going, right? And you've just got to be able to have that march to keep them honest.
It's also that I think a lot of the best decks have extra removal right now, in addition to put in tiers. Like, I think one of the big reasons Targ is so powerful is that Targ has those two extra removal cards, where with Dracarys and with Plaza, they're going to get through those little guys and be able to punish you. Greyjoy has that targeted removal and extra kill and runs higher claim. So they get you down to that point where even if you're not marching the big guy, you're marching the other guy, which leaves opening.
That's a solid point, Aaron. And do you guys find when you're building your decks in 2.0 that just like you're putting in economy cards, you are selectively saying, I'm going to put in XYZ removal cards just because I know I need to include removal?
I think removal is still the key to the game.
I think it's way more so than it ever was in 1.0.
It's interesting, though. Some of that removal, I think, has kind of fallen by the wayside, at least in our meta. Like, Put to the Sword, I think, is almost dropped off entirely down there.
Nope, whereas Tears,
all right. I mean, Tears is still, you know, pretty much everywhere that can support it, even maybe some houses that don't have as good of an argument for it. But
I find it to be stronger there when you're playing it out of a house that you traditionally, your opponent will say, well, I don't have to worry about Tears here. And then you rock the surprise Tears. It's even better. Like, a Stark fealty that's rolling Tears right now is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. I can see that. There's just such a lower bar to actually play that even those light intrigue houses can pull it off.
I think the importance of removal is very deck dependent. I think that in a sort of a heavy aggro deck, I don't know how much you need the removal beyond just the general attrition. Like, the targeted removal of a Put to the Sword is quite a steep cost to pay. Like, the tempo hit of having to save the gold back is quite heavy for a lot of decks, and I think it's only the fact that it is an extra card that's leaving the table that means those decks are running it, rather than for the actual sort of targeted element of it. I feel like I've worded that badly.
I think the only cards that matter are the big ones, and I think there's just very limited ways to get rid of those. So if there's a way to get rid of it, I tend to run it. Like, Fiery Followers aren't beating me usually. It's the Melisandre or the Bob that I need to get off the board. And anything that gets those off the board, I think, is how you win games in 2.0.
Yeah, I think it also depends on... Sorry.
Wait.
Go ahead, James.
Okay, I was just going to say, I think it also depends on what your deck is actually trying to do. Like, if you're playing a wall deck, maybe you don't really care that much about removing specific characters unless they're producing enough power to outrace you. If you're playing a rush deck, maybe you don't care so much about your opponents, I don't know, you know, like Tywin or whatever, helping fund their characters, if you're just going to try and race to 15 before they can stop you.
True. I just don't think rush exists until next month. Sorry. What?
Nothing.
Getting back to James's original point, or original conversation topic, which was assessing the spine of a deck and asking the question of, has it changed, you know? I guess what I'm kind of hearing you guys say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that most of you are saying it really hasn't changed, that the same premises of deck types, while they might be different from deck to deck, for the most part, they're still the same, and you're still building the decks the same way, and there might be a few cards different, but the actual design notion is still the same.
Here's a major difference.
I think there are some cards that have sort of gone in and out of favor amongst that. Like, at the start of play, a lot of what we were seeing was Milk of the Poppy, Littlefinger, comparatively less Varys. The plot decks were all over the place. And I think things sort of have tended towards a certain style. And then I think that's been further compounded by the addition of cards like Nymeria and like Sirio that sort of is making people start to look back towards Milk of the Poppy, where maybe they've been cutting it from their decks, especially after Here to Serve came out and you could search for Maester Crescent whenever you wanted. Now people are starting to consider including it again to be able to take out these problem characters. And yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for how much of that is the new cards, how much of that is the evolution of the meta, how much of that is just sort of natural fluctuation.
So a recent change, I think, is both initiative and attachments are on a huge upswing. Like, initiative matters more than ever with the rise of that Greyjoy boat. and then attachments that both help that Greyjoy boat and help slow down things like Nymeria and all the burn we're seeing are both on a very big upswing suddenly.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Definitely fair points. I think that also we're starting to gradually start the creep towards the efficiency mentality as opposed to the, you know, Voltron mega tank mentality where, you know, there was a good long while where the meta was dominated by Tywin Seal of the Hand. And I think we're getting further and further away from that.
That's interesting. I've been seeing Seal of the Hand more and more.
Yeah, I think Seal is going everywhere. I think it's, instead of Tywin Seal of the
Hand.
Seeing
Seal of the Hand, exactly my point here. As opposed to seeing, I'm going to get my one guy and I'm going to dupe him up and I'm going to put the Seal of the Hand on him and I'm going to win with him. It's, I'm going to make sure that I can get Seal of the Hand on somebody and I'm going to efficiently win games.
I mean, there's still a main body to get Seal on. It's just there's other acceptable bodies.
Whoever there is. But you don't lose if you lose your time. You know, it's, I'm going to find a way to get it on somebody that can win me the game.
What we're talking about is natural meta cycles. And you also have to understand we all play regionally. Unless you are a regular Octagon player, most of us have a kind of a local group that we play with in our area. And different regions will be in different steps of that cycle. You know, you mentioned Milk of the Poppy. It was popular at first. Everyone started playing Confiscation. Milk of the Poppy started, you know, evaporating from deck lists, and therefore Confiscation started evaporating from deck lists. Now Milk of the Poppy, you know, every group is going to be at a different stage of that cycle. Even the online group is essentially its own metagame. So, you know, I think it's just relevant to note that this is just part of a naturally evolving metagame, as it will go through cycles like this.
Yeah, well said. I think one card that I've been finding myself including a lot more recently is Rattleshirt's Raiders. And part of the reason for that is what you were saying about cycles. I like the fact that unlike Confiscation, it's not terrible, even if the opponent is in their lack of attachments stage of the cycle, because it's still a reasonable body.
I'm right there with you, James.
Yep.
I didn't play that card at all, but I play it a lot now.
I was renting.
And you're not in any danger of being forced to hit your own attachments.
Yes.
Yep.
It's a very solid card. It's an inefficient body, but when it can completely force your opponent to play a different way. And anything that changes the way your opponent plays has value.
Yeah, and I think gold, I never thought I'd say this, but 4 gold is just low enough that I don't mind the body being a bit rubbish occasionally. Like, I'm happy to have a 4 gold guy who's a bit disappointing and maybe only claim soak in some games, which is mad from a first edition perspective. But I think it's the upside is high enough and the downside isn't low enough that he just wins out for me most, in at the very least, in all non-fealty decks. I've been finding myself running 2 or 3 copies.
Yeah.
Greg,
go.
Go ahead, Aaron. My comment is kind of off topic.
Okay. He gets significantly better with First Snow in the meta, too. There aren't enough 4-cost characters in the game yet, and every 4-coster's value just takes a really big boost
up. First Snow particularly inflates the value of military icons on the 4-costers, because the military claim is going to be hitting higher-cost characters.
Absolutely.
You smart.
What I wanted to say is getting to hear James say rubbish really made me happy, and I hope he says it several more times before the end of the episode. He's not going to do it for me, is he?
I couldn't hear what you were saying. The signal went.
So, well, then, I mean, as far as the rest of the episode goes here, and as far as the spine of these decks go, is there anything else to talk about in the broad sense beyond just kind of this acceptance that the change that we've seen so far appears to have just been, by and large, part of this natural ebb and flow of these meta cycles, as well as, I would argue, a little bit about kind of a compression in, kind of an awkward way of me to phrase this, a compression in what you see in decks due to the expansion of the card pool, if that makes sense.
so much of what we've talked about has to do with specific card selections going in and out of favor, and how, you know, the influx of a given chapter pack and a given card influenced our choices and the way that we look at the meta. But in the general sense, the spine of a deck, how much of that has generally changed when it comes to how do you break down your cost curve? How do you break down the amount of events and non-setupable cards do you play? Like, I think that that is all stuff that's still worth talking about right now. If we want to get into something that is universal across archetype, across, you know, card specification.
So, I mean, I'm curious about that.
Universally, generally at least one removal event and then Hand's Judgment in most decks, it seems. Then
Hand's
whether you do a second removal.
People seem to either love it or hate it.
Yeah, it seems to kind of be a bit on that cyclical nature.
It's been so much more. Like, I very rarely feel like I'm playing games where my opponent doesn't have it anymore.
I think that's a great point of what Greg said about it being a regional situation, because I've talked to people in one area where they see it all the time and others where they see it never.
Man, okay. I just feel like with Targ being everywhere and with Support of the People being so key for Greyjoy, with Treachery being a nightmare for everybody, it's a plot that should, it's an event that should be around more if it's not around.
I couldn't agree with you more. I run it specifically because of Drakkaris.
Yeah. Like, every other reason is there, and it's helpful, but, like, Drakkaris just wins game. Well, I feel like we're seeing significantly fewer condition attachments as a rule. Thoughts?
Well, since Here to Serve, and obviously letting you fetch Crescent on a whim.
Yeah, basically.
I think I was seeing...
How many opponents have you actually had do that?
None. One.
That's my point, is that I feel like it's one of those things where just the possibility of it has changed the meta. But if you talk to anybody, anecdotally, no one has actually ever seen it happen in a tournament.
I know. If we're going with just the anecdotal route, I play the most games with my fiancée, Becky, and she runs Lannister Banner of the Stag as her deck and has Grandmaster Pycelle and Maester Cressen and its serve. And as a result, I basically can't run condition attachments because if I do, then I lose all my games.
And how many times have you played a tournament against her? That's what I said. Anecdotally, within the bounds.
I played her round one of the only store championship I've gone to so far, and she beat me.
Well, you, sir, are a statistical anomaly.
In so many ways.
So I'm seeing less and less outside of Greyjoy, I guess, and Barra. Fewer and fewer, I think, is actually the right way. Locations that do things.
I mean, there's just only so many options for locations that do things at the moment.
I'm seeing less Sunspear. I'm seeing less Lannisport. I'm seeing less Casterly. I'm seeing less of, I guess the Stark Draw one I still see a fair amount of, but not a ton. Like,
they have no other option.
Yeah. Like, I see the Burn location, I see Red Keep, and then Still Painted Table,
you mean
and then
Plaza
I see
Punishment.
That's what I was trying to say. Sorry.
I see everywhere.
Yeah, Plaza, Red Keep, and then the Greyjoy Suite, and like most other houses tend to be running mostly economy.
Yeah, I think
I'm seeing Lannisport a lot.
A lot of the locations that currently exist in the game, you need to do something to make them do something for you. If that makes sense. So, like.
I feel like
I've learned that the wheelhouse
are popular. I'm seeing less wheelhouse. Sorry,
was that, especially with Greyjoy everywhere. He's seeing wheelhouse a lot, and I'm seeing less because Greyjoy is everywhere, and they want to go first.
So here's a theoretical question.
I see that, and I also see
that wheelhouse is a one-off.
Yeah. Will, you had a question?
Yeah. I've got a theoretical here for you. Are you guys seeing a compression in the amount of locations or effect locations? Granted, I still say I don't feel like I'm seeing it, but I do feel like I've seen a contraction in other card types, notably the event and attachment slot. So I'm wondering if this is part of an overall trend that goes back to what Tommy kind of started to mention earlier about just some really broad stroke kind of ratio things. I feel like the game in general has settled down on higher character counts than we were used to in first edition. I feel like the default, again, this is broad strokes that I acknowledge would go up or down depending on the specific deck, but I feel like the default starting point for people who would tweak from there in first edition was about 30 characters. Now in second edition, I feel like that's more like 35-ish.
Totally.
And those
agree.
Slots have to come from somewhere.
Yeah, I've been running in the high 30s for characters.
Yeah, I aim about 35. Then
how many cards that you can't set up are you guys playing? I think this is the root of what we're looking for.
10 to 13. 10-ish events, and then 2 to 3 seal.
Yeah,
James?
I feel like I've compressed that.
I mean, I play Tyrell a lot, so that's 2 to 3 pleasure barges typically added on.
Yeah.
And then a healthy number of attachments. which are very, that you can set them up, but they're quite volatile as to whether or not you do set them up.
Right.
So yeah, typically I'd say maybe a dozen, maybe a little over.
And Will, you were saying?
Yeah, I feel like I've stripped mine down to like 10, probably being the tops. I feel like the importance of setup with our, granted, there is a broader amount of draw available to the different houses, but the total available to each one is so low compared to second that I feel like the importance of that setup has been even higher. And with the economy being more important, trying to maximize that setup and use exactly 8 gold, if at all possible, is more important to me. So anything that throws off my setup ability has been really worrying.
I'm right there with you. I'm usually 9 to 11. And the thing that troubles me when I think about that is that not only do I have 9 to 11 cards that I can't set up, but I also potentially have that limited overlap where I, you know, additionally have cards that I can't set up.
To be fair, if you have multiple limited cards, you're probably okay. Because I think most of the time at the moment, the really bad setups are the ones where you just don't have economy.
Yeah.
That's true. I would agree with that as well. But, I mean, if you end up with two Rose Roads, then that's negative. But if you have a Rose Road and a King's Road, then you're happy.
Yeah.
What about you?
In most games, I wouldn't be unhappy if I had two Rose Roads in my setup hand.
Agreed. Like, just how much limited are you guys running?
I wouldn't have to worry about it.
Oh, wait, I've got another question about that. How much limit are you running? And B, would you rather a 4-card setup without economy or a 3-card setup with, assuming 2 characters either way?
Yeah,
wait, say that
either
last part again?
Setup, so.
So, A, how many limited are you running? B, a 3-card setup, like, say, 2 characters either way. A 3-card setup with 2 characters or a 4-card setup with no economy?
Hmm. That's interesting.
In the abstract, I think I picked a 3-card with economy, but I think it would also depend, like, assuming I'm looking at my hand and saying I could do either of these, I think it also matters to me if the 4-card setup uses 8 gold but doesn't start economy, but the 3-card uses 5 gold and starts economy. I have to consider that.
Well, and what house am I playing? Is one of the cards that is no economy a Tyrion? You know?
Yeah.
Like, those are things to consider.
Right. There's a million, like, little things in the abstract here. Like, because generally in the abstract, I think I'm taking the 3 with economy. Economy is...
For sure.
I agree.
In the abstract, I agree with that as well. In general, to answer your first part of the question, when it comes to limited cards, I generally play 8.
Yeah, I'd say 6 to 8 myself.
For me, it depends a lot on whether it's a banner or a fealty. Not just that, but the split in the banner. If it's a relatively even split in the banner, it's really difficult to play the faction reducing locations.
Yep.
Whereas if you've got, you know, if you're only running the bare minimum of 12 from one faction, or if you're false bannering and the main banner's running, or the main faction's running even lower, then it's a lot easier to expand past the 3 King's Road and 3 Rose Road.
Go ahead, James.
Are we both about to ask the same question of what limiteds do you run in the fealty deck?
I was certainly going to say that, and then I was going to say that it segues well into when you're playing a banner deck, what do you tend to find yourself playing? Is it a bare minimum, or are you finding yourself playing an even mix? So let's go with that first portion about the fealty.
9.
You go with 9, do you?
Yeah, I really want that extra setup because my characters are likely to have less impact. I want to be able to play things when I need to. I can't afford to hold back at all.
Well, in a fealty deck, that's going to limit the rest of your neutrals, though. I mean, that means you're eating up 6 of your neutrals right there.
Yep, always. So sometimes I've dropped a Rose Road once or twice at Kern's insistence, but it's rare.
In a fealty deck, I'm probably dropping King's Roads.
Yeah, I drop King's
Not
Roads.
Not all 3, I mean, but I'm probably playing, you know, 3 of the house-specific reducers, 3 Rose Roads, and 1, maybe 2 King's Roads, depending on which fealty deck I'm playing. But I would say I don't run fealty very often, and most of my decks are dual house, and I'm generally only running 6 limited locations in my banner decks, 3 King's Roads and 3 Rose Roads.
Oh, and aside? I tried to do taxation and run like 12 limited, and when you see 5, taxation doesn't actually help. Just a thought.
No. Yeah.
And also, it doesn't help on setup as well.
Yeah.
So, do you feel like there is any single must-have thought on on deck spines here, or is it worth it to kind of take things out to the listeners, to the comment fields, and kind of see where the discussion goes from here?
I would really like to touch on, at a macro level, where you guys are at in terms of your bannering. Are you bannering equally, or are you bannering at a minimum?
Oh, as far as card count from
ratio,
the other faction. I feel like I'm just over minimum. I think 15 cards is kind of my default.
That's where I find myself too.
Yeah,
I find.
I'm doing. Oh, go ahead, James.
I was just going to say that typically, if I am bothering with the banner, usually there's enough in the other faction that I want that I'm not just sticking to 12. And that if there are only 12 cards that I want, then I'm probably more likely to just go fealty or no agenda / banner to itself. Mm-hmm. Not always, but often.
I am probably doing neither of the options, Tommy, that you mentioned. I am bannering to the position of integration. What I mean by that is I'm building decks with the cards from both the houses I want for the purposes of the deck. Then when I'm done, I go back and count and make sure that I meet the qualifications of the agenda. And I basically am working on it that way. And I would say that there is really no set tendency of my banner decks to be one way or the other. It's just pretty much once I reach a point that I have my integration saturation that I'm looking for, then I'm set. I go.
So you're saying that you're much more case by case. I would agree that when I build my decks that I'm much more case by case as well. However, what I find when I go through that case by case build, that generally I'm between 13 and 16 cards that I end up selecting from my off house, just because there is such a limited amount of non-loyal, efficient cards that are available at this point.
I build from my banner first. Once I've gotten every card I want from my banner, I build from the main house, and then I cut down wherever extra cards are. I tend to cut a little bit more from the banner because I tend not to be running their limited economy, and that is a slight negative that tends to leave me heavier in the main house.
Just quickly touching back on the limited thing, do you guys find limited changing at all when you're involving Lannister because of the moneylender?
I don't run the moneylender.
I do run the moneylender.
How many do you usually run, Greg?
Between two or three.
Yeah, I usually run
two and a half. He cuts one in half.
King Solomon.
Yep. Yeah, I would agree. I'd say Lannister generally pushes my limited count up. Two is probably my most common play there. So I'm most commonly playing eight limited in Lannister, but I'm not a big fealty guy. I'm almost always bannering. So that, of course, changes how I look at the limited in-house reducers and such.
Totally.
Okay.
So a final thought. I think that this conversation and where it went has really driven home the point that I really think the most important part of 2.0 is economy and economy base. I think almost everything we talked about, everything about setup, everything about how and why we play what we do, came down to cost effectiveness and being able to afford to do what we want. And I just think economy is extraordinarily important, and that can't be overstated for our listeners.
If economy is one, removal 1A. That's the way that I look at it.
That's what I was going to say. Economy is the most important thing, but if you can't stop your opponent from running riot with their characters, then you're probably going to lose.
So let's change our saying. Since we were draw equals win forever, let's change it. Let's be economy equals win.
I'm awfully tempted to say it.
I know, you got to draw that economy, though, haven't you?
No, because I think economy...
Damn your pragmatism.
No, I think economy is significantly more important early in the game. Like, I think seeing economy early magnifies it for really...
Yeah, but if you don't see any economy, then you can't win with it.
Well, yeah, but you have
to
have setup.
Right, but in 1.0, did you ever make plot decisions based on economy? Ever?
No.
Very rarely.
So, point is, right there, the decision is to make it rain.
Props and slaps.
So I want to slap Manny Pacquiao for being amazingly homophobic. Homophobia is not acceptable, guys.
You don't even know what you're talking about?
Manny Pacquiao said, do you guys know who Manny Pacquiao is?
Yeah.
Gay people are worse than animals.
Wow. Honey badgers.
Was there any kind of context associated with this, or is this just a general statement that he made?
That's the general statement he made, and he lost, like, a bunch of...
endorsements, I would
endorsements,
hope.
Endorsements, and, yeah. I mean, I just think it's appropriate for us as a whole to generally note that homophobia is not acceptable, especially after the week we just had.
Shame on you, Manny Pacquiao.
I would like to give slops to us, because this is essentially the Jinx episode. We were either all talking on top of each other, or we were all sitting there quiet. So
yeah, exactly. This is going to be bad. There's something else terrible.
Hey, at least we had opinions.
Good job, guys.
We'll see how well this one works. Well, I want to throw out some props. I'm going to throw some out. I know, it's trite, but I'm throwing props out. It's a Deadpool. I watched it on Monday, and it rocked.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. I mean, it the role really is just, like, tailor-made for Ryan Reynolds. It's pretty fantastic.
Looking forward to seeing it.
So, yeah. No spoilers past that.
I'm going to prop Young Justice, which is on Netflix, and really good.
Oh, yeah, it's great. I need to watch season two.
How about props to Archer for the spoiler commercials that they have out?
You know, I don't really watch regular TV anymore, so I've missed the commercials for Archer.
They have an entire YouTube channel where you can watch all the spots.
Ooh, guess I should check
all
that
at once. You gotta check it out, which is fucking hilarious.
I want to prop Chrono Trigger, because I just like, yeah. What I'm going to do after this, Bruno sent me a deck, I'm going to edit Bruno's deck, then I'm going to edit Patrick Kane's deck, then I'm going to watch all the endings on Chrono Trigger on YouTube, because I'm off this week.
Nice.
Way to be.
Prop being off this week. I'm enjoying that as well.
Yeah, props to James for being here at 4 a.m. his time.
It's so much easier when your boss tells you you've got a bunch of leave you need to take before the end of March. Here's a week, take it. Sure.
Yeah, there's first world problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Props to me for being able to make Gen Con, and slops to me for booking it the day before the UK distributor announced when the UK Nationals were, and so now I can't make the UK Nationals because my journey back clashes with it.
Oh no.
It'll be worth it.
It will be, but it's going to sting on the way back while I'm in the plane knowing that all the UK meta are in Poland getting drunk because it also clashes with Gleebrom for a car.
Oh my god.
Make you sick at that point.
Yeah, that's Gen Con's going to be a... prep your liver. If I can go to any tournament in the world, it'll be the Furka. It's just the perfect time. Those guys drink.
Booyah.
Hey, props to the European meta in general. I miss them. It's always, like, I know this sounds dumb, but every time there's a controversy in the community, like, I get to talk to everyone, and, like, so I talked to the majority of the European meta this week, and, like, I really miss talking to everybody, and it was a really good, I mean, even though the conversation started off about negative stuff, we ended up just catching up, and it was really awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. I never thought when I started playing this game that my favorite part of it would be chatting to random people on a different continent, but it is. So, there you go.
Yep.
Which continent is that?
Africa.
Oh, I thought you were going to say America. Fuck yeah.
He doesn't like Americans. He likes Canadians.
They're basically like junior Americans, aren't they?
Junior Americans, I fucking love that. Yes.
Oh, Will?
That's how South Park treats them, right?
Me what?
Oh, I thought you were going to say it. Never mind.
Thus closes another chapter of the White Book. Not a question. That is definitive.
That was well done. Guessed. We'll be right back.